The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Okay, so we're going to be doing Parshas Mishpatim, and we plan to finish the entire Parsha today. So I'm just going to give you a quick synopsis of everything that's happening in Mishpatim, and then we'll try and tie it together and see how it thematically fits into the Chumash. So Mishpatim, being the Parsha right after Yitro, Yitro is the Parsha that deals with the encounter with God, the face-to-face, the revelation at Sinai, the Ten Commandments. And now we have here particular laws which are also considered to be given at Sinai. And it basically starts off with laws dealing with an Eved Ivri, a Jewish slave, a person who, this is at least one of the opinions, a person who stole something and was not in a position to pay it back, right, and pay the particular fine back. And so such a person, the Bet Din, sells as a slave. And we're taught that the slave is only for 6 years. In the 7th year, he goes out. And if the slave says, I really like my master, I don't want to go free, so they take him, and we pierce his ear by driving a spike, a nail or whatever, through his earlobe next to the mezuzah in the door. In other words, you're painting through the door, meaning that basically you pierce his ear. Okay. Then talks about laws dealing with murder, intentional murder, unintentional murder, refuge cities for the unintentional the people who did unintentional murder. Talks about hitting your mother and father and causing a wound, which incurs a death penalty, kidnapping, cursing parents, the laws is to the nature of that, hitting any person, the various laws of compensation in terms of what happened to the person, what happens if you kill your servant, what happens when two people are fighting and they accidentally hit a woman who's pregnant and the baby dies, those type of laws. And we have here the famous line of eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, which Judaism does not take literally, but it's a figurative way of emphasizing the seriousness of what happened and that one has to compensate according to a certain amount of money that the eye would have been worth. In terms of how they calculate, that's not for now. Anyways, what happens if you damage the eye or the tooth of your slave? He goes free. And then in terms of your ox, what happens if an ox kills another ox? What happens if you own an ox and you were warned 3 times that your ox has done something not appropriate? Who pays? What's the laws? Laws of negligence in terms of leaving a hole uncovered and someone falling into it, laws of theft, armed robbery, if your animal goes out and damages somebody's field, if your fire damages someone's field, what if you put something in someone's charge to guard it, and while they're holding onto it, it gets damaged, or it gets stolen, or if somebody borrows something, it gets stolen. Okay. There's laws dealing with bestiality, with witchcraft, offering sacrifices to idol worship, caution against offending the ger, offending the widow, the orphan, laws dealing with loans, prohibition against cursing the judge or the prince, lashon hara, fairness and justice. If you find the ox of your enemy, or if your enemy needs some help, laws of bribe, Shemitah, Shabbos, festivals, first fruits, and milk and meat. It's a long list of various detailed laws. And then God says to Moses that I have sent my angel before you to take you into the land of Israel. And they are cautioned to make sure they get rid of the people that are in the land of Israel and get rid of their idol worship. And then we end off with Moses going up to the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. So that's Mishpatim. So now we just want to see this. I mean, I'm not going to go into the details because this is a number of Masechtot, a number of tractates in the Talmud. I mean, so much Talmud is written on these few lines here. So I'm certainly not going to get into that, but we want to get into the more philosophical, thematic construction of the Parsha and how it fits in. So in a simple sense, Yitro is that unbelievable encounter with God, that moment of ecstasy, that event of transcendence, where they see face to face the divine. And we're at this incredible high point. The Torah is given, the Ten Commandments. And yet, in stark contrast to that, with all its generalities and all its spirit and vision, Mishpatim seems to be the very opposite. It's very detailed, meticulous, day-to-day laws of day-to-day people. So, in a conceptual way, Yitro is the encounter with God, the divine human encounter, and the various general principles that reflect that. But Mishpatim are the details, derivatives of that kind of encounter. In other words, a person needs both that ideal, and yet also the practical day-to-day laws that express that ideal. Now we have to understand that Parshas Mishpatim, these very meticulous laws, are an expression of that moment of transcendence. They are the completion of that event of transcendence. And that's something that people don't generally understand. Very often, you know, to get high isn't hard. You have this incredible experience and vision and uplifting elevation. Wow, right? You're really very high. And yet that high, the real challenge is translating that high, that encounter with God, into the rigorous day-to-day responsibilities of relation between man and man, man and God, all the daily kinds of responsibilities. And we believe that those details are the direct manifestation of that lofty event, and are the direct way to achieve, once again, that lofty event. So, in Judaism, we have something called halakha. And halakha means a path, a way. And that's what halakha is. Halakha is the way to get back to that face-to-face encounter with God daily. How do you get there? The only way to get there is through that day-to-day responsibilities of Jewish law. Now, very often people do not appreciate how you have to unify the visions, the ideals, the general principles with those day-to-day rigorous laws and details. People don't realize how crucial that is. But in Judaism, you cannot have one without the other. Right? Those very apparently boring kind of day-to-day things that you have to do are precisely how one reconnects to the Sinaitic experience. And very often people are much more into the spirit of the law and yet seem to forget the very meticulous letters of the law. And in Judaism, we have the halakha as the way to get back to that experience. And that it's the vehicle. In fact, the numerical value of the word halakha is exactly kli, which means vessel. Very often people want the light, the visions, the experience. But they don't realize that you need the vessel. Because light without a vessel isn't real. It dissipates. It doesn't come down. It doesn't do anything for you. So, in contrast to a certain extent, popular Christian ideas, we believe that the particularities are crucial in bringing us to and maintaining our connection to Sinai. You see, if you ask a Christian, why don't you keep Jewish law? Well, you think of it, why don't they keep Jewish law? I mean, why not? I mean, the fact that you believe that a particular man is your Mashiach, is your Messiah, why in any way does that then mean that you are no longer obligated in Jewish law? I mean, why don't Christians keep Shabbos, kosher? I mean, all the laws. And Jesus himself kept the laws. So why is it that they don't keep the laws? We're I mean, if there's a difference of opinion of who is the Mashiach, that's one thing. But no matter who the Mashiach is, there is no indication, nor support or evidence that you would know law at the point that Mashiach comes, we're absolved from keeping the law. So no matter whether you believe in Jesus or not, there's no reason why these people should not be keeping Jewish law. So if you ask them why you're not keeping the Jewish law, then one of the popular answers is because Jesus kept the letter of the law, leaving us only the need to keep the spirit of the law. That's what they hold. That they are responsible in the spirit. And Jesus has already fulfilled the letter for them. That's what they say. And to a certain extent, when it comes to spirit, they've got a lot of spirit. And let's face it, there's a lot of spirit. When my wife and I got married, we lived very close to the center of town, a block away from a church. And this was quite an active church, and they had services every Saturday morning. Now, why Saturday morning? What? No, because there's work on Sunday in Israel. So you got to do it on Saturday morning, and they want to attract the Jews. So, but I have to admit, on a nice spring morning, where it's nice and warm, the windows are open, we would hear incredible singing, incredible rejoicing coming from this church. It would come all the way to my house, a block away. And I was impressed. I have to admit that I was very impressed with their spirit. But then again, even though one could be impressed with Christian spirit, Christian practical actions, I'm not so impressed with what has happened throughout history in the name of Christianity. You see, spirit is one thing, but to really direct it, to really maintain it, to really integrate with the spirit, you must have those meticulous laws that express it, maintain it, establish it, and reconnect you to it all the time. And that's what Mishpatim is all about. Mishpatim seems to be a stark contrast to Yitro and all its visions, right? And it's very general principles, and yet it gets down to very serious nitty-gritties. But you see, Mishpatim is the fulfillment of Yitro. The fulfillment of those lofty visions, those general principles, are only in those very meticulous, articulate laws that affect the everyday here and now. And that what people generally don't understand. I mean, on one hand, we seem to be overwhelmed by the apparent din orientation of this parsha. Like, it's very judge-oriented. If you do this, you get killed. You do that, you get killed. And, you know, Yitro seems to be this chesed, this moment of awesome divine love that God, because certainly we didn't deserve to have the revelation of God at Sinai. What could a human being do to deserve a revelation at Sinai? There's nothing you could do. So Sinai is an incredible moment of chesed, and yet Mishpatim seems to be so din-oriented, so much harsh, hard laws and rules. And yet for Judaism, the laws and the rules are the fulfillment of the chesed. The great chesed of God, the great kindness of God, is that He gives us very meticulous, very real day-to-day laws that relate to the very real day-to-day situations and enable us to have that possibility to take responsibility for ourselves, where there are real consequences to what we do. So the din of Mishpatim is the fulfillment and ultimately the expression of the chesed of Yitro. Now, we start off with the laws of slavery. And of course, why is that, of all laws, the first particular law we're given? It seems like it doesn't seem to be important, or it seems to be the least important. I mean, now, don't murder, and hurting your mother and your father, and to talk about a slave seems to be quite out of place, but it's not. Because it really correlates with I am God who's taken you out of Egypt from the house of slavery. And your past experience should serve as an educational introduction to how you should behave to slaves and servants in the future. You see, in Judaism, the laws relating to a servant are so difficult that it says that if you buy a servant, you have bought yourself a master. The amount of care and consideration that the Jew had to have for a servant was so high that I would say that being a servant to a Jew, for many people, was like an incredible opportunity. Incredible opportunity. And of course, what kind of servant are we talking about? We're talking about a person who has been involved in theft, and being that he's not able to pay for his deeds, he's sold as a servant, as a slave. And yet, only for 6 years and no more. You're not allowed to enslave this person with the kind of burden and oppression that the Egyptians did to you. Rather, it's only for a short amount of time. In the seventh year, you let him go. According to some commentaries, Parshas Mishpatim is actually the elaboration of the last of the Ten Commandments, which was Al Tachmod, right? Which is do not desire the property of your friend, being his slave, his house. And therefore all the various laws here deal with an appreciation for how much something belongs to someone else and how careful, how particularly careful and sensitive you must be to others' ownership. But when you look at it, we can't help but feel a little bit disappointed in these laws or in the need for them to be mentioned. Because, I mean, you know, laws about murder, laws about armed robbery, laws about cursing your mother and your father. I mean, who's God talking to? I mean, these are the people that are standing at Sinai. These are people who have reached a lofty level of godliness that they could stand before God. And these are the kinds of laws that that lofty nation has to hear. You see that as a little disturbing? I mean, these are the first laws. They're at Sinai. Can you imagine the heights these people have reached, the transcendent level they're on? And they're being told, don't kill, and armed robbery, and cursing this. It seems to not be appropriate. And yet, that's precisely the point in Judaism. That to get high is one thing, but to stay on that level is another. And basically, in a simple sense, Judaism is what is called realistic. Because Judaism is for a nation. Judaism is not for a group of individuals that are all tzaddikim. It's for a nation. And a nation has all kinds of people. And Judaism relates to the real situation of people, their real yetzaharas, and chooses and directs them towards back to Sinai. In other words, the Jewish people reach this lofty level at Sinai, but they're not going to stay on that lofty level. Because it takes years and years and years of work to get back to that level of your own. And the Jewish people still have a certain yetzahara. And so very often when people look at the modern state of Israel, they say, ah, that's the state, that's not the state that the prophets prophesied. How could that be? You know, there's robbery, and there's theft, and there's murder, and there's rape. I mean, all these things happen in the Jewish state. That couldn't be the state that God prophesied. And we see it is. We see in the Bible that it is. That God already understands that the Jewish people and their Yetzirah, and immediately they're given laws that relate to creating a society and relating to the pitfalls of such a society. And then we are also, on a more subtle note, a little surprised by laws of slavery. I mean, why do the Jews have laws of slavery at all? I mean, who would know better than the Jews of the apparent immorality of owning a slave? And how could that be? Yeah, there's another principle that must be clarified about Judaism. Halakha means the way to God. Halakha doesn't necessarily express the ideals of Judaism. Halakha expresses the way to the ideals of Judaism. The ideals of Judaism are not that to have a slave. But as Maimonides says, God breaks the Jewish people in slowly, so to speak. You see, you're talking about a society, an era where slavery is completely acceptable. It's the norm. And to just snap the fingers and the Jewish people transform overnight is not possible, is not realistic, is not what Torah is all about. We have to realize that when we read laws in Judaism, we cannot necessarily assume, sometimes yes, but sometimes no, that that law represents the ideals of Judaism. It represents how to get to the ideals. And therefore, the fact that this society has already accepted slavery under certain limitations, with certain very sensitive conditions as to the nature of the comfortability of your slave, that already is a quantum leap forward. And today, you see the Jewish people do not engage in slave trade, right? We would say, that's the success of Torah. The success of Torah is that it slowly brought us out of it, and now we're not even into that. Right? So the Torah, as it says in the oral tradition, God says, I created a Torah, I created a Yetzirah, and I created Torah as its antidote. Meaning the Torah speaks to the Yetzirah of a human being with the intention to fix you, to change you, to direct you, to cultivate you. And therefore, even though we look at some of these laws here in the 20th century, we look at them and say, really? I mean, that just doesn't seem even moral. Right? Well, we would say that that gut feeling that you would aspire to higher than that is precisely the success of being Jewish. That the laws of Judaism, its halakha, slowly transform mankind, that they would appreciate things like not having a slave, because they started off with a sensitivity towards slaves in the first place. And another approach to the idea is, in certain situations, a slave would actually be better. For instance, in the Industrial Revolution, when people were hiring people for peanuts, for nothing, and the factory conditions were just horrendous, and people were dying and getting sick within a short amount of time, and then the employee doesn't care, just hires himself somebody else. In that situation, think about it, wouldn't it be better to institute slave laws? Because if you own that person, you would be much more sensitive to their needs, because you wouldn't want your slave that you paid for, right, to be damaged in your coal mine that you're not properly taking care of, right? However, you see, certain things that look immoral to you within the context might be actually much more moral and a way to fix that which is truly immoral. Okay? So when we look at these laws, see, very meticulous and articulate, and some of them seem to be like behind our times, recognize they're not behind our times, that precisely what got us to our times as a halacha. Halacha meaning a way, a path to the ideals. Okay. Now the other thing that we notice about these mishpatim is that they start off with laws between man and man, and they end off with laws between man and God. Because it starts off with laws relating to slaves, and it slowly, gradually transforms into laws between man and God. It ends off with the law not to eat milk and meat together. And so what's strange about that? It seems to be going in the opposite order of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments start off with the laws between God and man and God, and then it graduates towards the laws between man and man, right? And here it's the switch. Why? And as I mentioned before, many commentaries say that it starts off elucidating the particular details of Lo Tachmod, not to desire, which was the last of the Ten Commandments. So it's like starting from the bottom and going up again. You see, this is something very crucial, because there's the hierarchy of ideals, and then there's the hierarchy in terms of practically how do you get there. The ideal of Judaism is the Dveikut of Hashem, the unity with God, the yearning for God's closeness. I am God, you're God, and all those deep philosophical principles of faith that a Jew lives with. How do you get there? It's through these very rigorous laws between man and man. The ideals start from Anochi Hashem Elokech, and that's the root of everything, as it goes down and it graduates towards laws between man and man. But how do you then once again ascend the ladder to that peak point of Sinai, I am God, your God? It's through the laws between man and man. Right? See, very often people are not sensitive to the laws between God and man. They say, oh, those laws. I mean, isn't the most important thing to be a good person? I'm a good person, I fulfill the laws between man and man. But we believe that the laws between man and man are only the expression of the laws between God and man, and are really the first rungs towards the laws between God and man. And they come together. You need the two. But a person should recognize that all your davening and all your holy worshiping comes after being sensitive to your fellow man. Because being sensitive to your fellow man, fulfilling the laws between man and man, are actually the first steps towards really, honestly, sincerely fulfilling the laws between God and man. And man and God. Okay? So we see that order. We see that order reversed, but it's not reversed. It's simply the practicalities of how you once again return to Sinai. Right? How you once again make it back to Sinai. It starts off as Va'elu ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. Rashi says Va'elu ha-mishpatim means, and in addition to the ones I just told you. Va'elu means an addition to what was before. That this was given at Sinai, just like the Ten Commandments are given at Sinai. Rashi, therefore, clarifying to realize that this, what we have here, is an extension of what happened to Sinai. That lofty experience at Sinai extends into the very daily responsibilities and sensitivities. Then it says, Asher tasim lifnehem, that you shall put before them. So Rashi brings down, what does it mean, you shall put before them? Like a shulchan aruch, like a table that is set, ready to be eaten before man. And what does that mean? And of course, this is where we get the word shulchan aruch. Right? The book of the laws of Judaism are called the shulchan aruch, which means a set table. Now, what was God telling Moshe by saying, these are the laws you shall put before them? The Old Testament says, put before them like a complete arranged table. Now, I think there are a number of implications here. I think it's telling Moshe and all leaders in the future about the responsibility to be an educator. Because, I mean, wasn't what God said enough? What is he going to add? To take the material of Torah and present it to the people according to them and who they are. It's a very beautiful, important idea. But when you look at the Shulchan Aruch, is it organized just like the Torah? And you say, why wasn't the Torah written like the Shulchan Aruch? Because the Shulchan Aruch is a much later presentation that Am Yisrael and the Chachamim, the wise people of Am Yisrael, are responsible in setting up this way so that it can come down this way. And set it before them like a table, ready to be eaten. Implying that, you know, when you set a table, one of the arts of setting a table is you set the food in a way that it's attractive, right? You set the table in such a way that it's appetizing. So too, I think there's an implication here of a responsibility that the law should be taught in a manner that it is attractive and that one has a sense of its tam, of its taste and its sweetness and its nourishment. Okay? So therefore, Moshe is being given the information, and yet God has instructed him that your responsibility is put it before them like a Shulchan Aruch. Right? You have a certain added educational responsibility as a human being to relate to the students according to their needs, right, of that generation. And Rashi continues to say, what does it mean? You shall put before them and not before Goyim. We learn from here, in the oral tradition, that if, let's say, a non-Jewish court has the same particular laws as the Jewish court, you are not allowed to go to a non-Jewish court. I mean, when you look at these laws, one could say, oh, these are the Hammurabi codes. You know, there are plenty of law systems that existed before the Torah, no? So, like, what's the difference? So, if I go into a court, and this court has the exact same law in terms of the particularities regarding my ox and damages, right? I go into a non-Jewish small claims court, which has happens to have the exact same laws as Judaism's laws. I'm not allowed to go there. Why? What's the difference? Kavanah. The difference is these are godly laws. The difference is we see the fulfillment of these laws crucial to getting to the laws between God and man. Man and God. And that they are not isolated and that they really don't have foundation or meaning or ultimate future unless they are bound up as a godly law. It's a different law by going into, I mean the difference between this law and the law in the non-Jewish court. The law in the non-Jewish court is the human being thinking how to establish law and order. And that's very nice. But the law of Judaism is not given in order to establish just law and order. The law in Judaism is not only to establish law and order, but to bring you back to I am God, your God. It's a different law. It's a completely different law. And therefore, we are not allowed to go to a non-Jewish court for this claim. We should go to a Jewish court for this claim. Because these laws bring us back to Sinai. Right? Completely different concern. And Rashi also brings down the Gemara that says, we learn from here that the Sanhedrin must be next to the altar. The Sanhedrin must be next to the altar. Now why next to the altar? The Sanhedrin would convene on Temple Mount. Why Temple Mount? Again, to teach you that law and order is not separate of and independent of worshiping God. But they must be juxtaposed. They must be together. You must realize that your yearning to come close to God is translated and expressed in laws like what happens when your ox hurts another person's ox. That itself is completely unified and an aspect of, an expression of, that yearning for the closeness of God that is at the temple and in the altar. Yeah?
Halakha, letter of the law, that you adhere to, there should be the complementary spirit of the law.
Yeah, I would say that's a valid shot. Because that's the point of this. Mishpatim is the vessels that really translate those visions at Sinai into the everyday and bring us back to Sinai, or bring Sinai back to us in the everyday. Because not every day can you have Sinai. Because now you got to go out, you got an ox, and your ox is, you know, acting up. But we believe, yes, it's now. That's what really Sinai means. Sinai means how you take care of your ox. It doesn't mean just standing there at a mountain in service of God, yearning to cleave to Shekhinah. It means watching your ox, covering a hole so someone doesn't fall into it. It means not speaking Lashon Hara. All the details day to day are precisely the way to maintaining our Sinai with you eternally. Alright. After all these laws, we jump to chapter 23, verse 20. After all these very particular and our detailed laws are given, God then tells Moses, behold, I am sending my angel before you to guard you in the way and take you to the place that I have established. Now, what does it mean that I'm going to send my angel before you? What's this angel that I'm going to send before you? So in a simple sense, the Chizkuni says this is referring to prophets, messengers, human messengers, and that the human messengers will direct you, referring to Yeshua when Moses dies. But Rashi brings down that it really literally means a malach, an angel. And what really God is telling Moses is in the future the Jewish people will sin and therefore will no longer be fitting my personal guiding them through the desert. I will rather just send my malach. The facts, however, is that when the Jewish people did sin, Moses refused to accept this from God and said, unless you go before us, we're not going. And God consented to Moses' request. And therefore, God personally led the Jewish people throughout the desert. Okay? But what this is announcing is, my angel will go before you, take you to the land of Israel, and there you will fight, you will battle. I will battle for you. Of course, when Judaism ever says, I will battle for you, that means that I will help you. Referring to, I will battle for you as if God is the first cause, and therefore everything that a human being does is considered to be what God is doing also. So that's a rule in Judaism. And it basically talks about, you go to the land of Israel, you will evacuate the land, you will destroy their idol worship, and do not leave any of the idol worshippers in the land, lest they become a trapping to you much later on, and you stray after their gods. So, the fulfillment of Mishpatim is going back to Eretz Israel. Because only in the land of Israel are the laws of Judaism considered to be completely effectualized. Outside the land of Israel, the laws do not have the same kind of potency in bringing us and drawing us close to God as in the land of Israel. And therefore, what is the land of Israel doing here? It's very clear, because it is in the land of Israel that the Mishpatim come alive, right? As a way to take us back to Sinai, or to bring Sinai back to us daily, okay? So outside the land of Israel, the laws are referred to as signposts to help you find your way back. But in the land of Israel, all the laws are the ongoing expression of our relationship with God that we experienced at Sinai being expressed daily. Okay? After we are told about going to the land of Israel and the wars, we jump to chapter 24. And here Moses, Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu, the 70 elders, ascend the mountain, but each had their own zone, so to speak. Not everyone was allowed to go to the same altitude. Okay? And in verse 3, Moses, they go up. In verse 3, Moses comes and tells the people all the words of God and all the mishpatim, and the entire people say, whatever God says, we will do. Now, there are various opinions how to translate that pasuk. According to the simple understanding, which some of the commentaries take, this is happening after the revelation of God at Sinai. The mishpatim were given at Sinai to Moses, and Moses is now coming down and telling the people all the laws that God just told us here. God said, these are the laws that you shall put before the people. God tells Moses all these laws while he's up on Sinai. Moses comes down, and now in this pasuk, Moses is telling the people everything he heard until now. That's, I think, probably the simplest way of reading this. However, Rashi says, no. This is actually before the Ten Commandments. And of course, there's a principle in Judaism, Ein Mukdam Mukham B'Torah, that not everything written in the Torah is according to its chronological order. And there's certain paragraphs that are actually put there, even though historically they came before, they're written after, or vice versa. So really, according to Rashi, what is this referring to? Moses comes to tell the Jewish people the laws, what laws? He tells them about the laws of Shabbos, the laws of honoring father and mother, the law of Rev Hefer, and the seven Noetic laws that they were given at Marah. Right, so he tells them those laws again. And then it says, when it says in verse 4, and Moses wrote all the words of God in the morning, what is that referring to, according to Rashi? Moses, of course, dictated to by God, writes the entire Torah from Bereishis to this moment, which is the giving of Torah at Sinai, just prior to that moment. So according to Rashi, before Moses goes up in the mountain and they heard the Ten Commandments, they already had prophetically been given the entire Torah until now. Okay? It was now being written. Alright, according to Rashi. No, nothing has been given. Except, according to Rashi, all this is happening before, like Eila Mishpatim, these verses happen before Eila Mishpatim. Okay? And therefore, what are these verses referring to? Not Eila Mishpatim, because it didn't happen yet. So it's referring to the book of Bereishis, all the way up to that moment, just before the Ten Commandments. Now, according to Rashi then, why is it written out of order? I mean, even though we have such a law that it could be written out of order, but there must be some philosophical reason for it being written out of order. I believe the philosophical reason is to teach us that all these laws take you back to the beginning of giving the Torah at Sinai. That after learning all these laws, you have to realize that they are actually the road back to Sinai. I hate using the word back, implies back in time. But it's the road back to that incredible encounter face to face with God. Okay, Moses builds an altar and effectualizes a covenant. Okay, God calls Moses up to the mountain. Now, he goes up and he is going to get the Luchot. According to Rashi, this is all fine because, according to Rashi, this is all happening before the Ten Commandments. And therefore, Moses goes up to get the tablets. According to the other opinions, this is happening after. And therefore, what's really going on is, first they heard it. Moses went down to tell the people. They all said fine. Then Moses was called up again to get the luchot, the tablets upon which were written the Ten Commandments, and that's when he went up for 40 days and 40 nights. And that is the completion of Mishpatim. Basically, Mishpatim is the detailed expression of what happens in Yitro. Okay? And that's basically it. Questions on what we did? It just doesn't happen. In other words, you have here laws about a man who sells his daughter. People don't do that anymore, right? But in those days, it was quite common, and therefore the law of Torah is not consenting to it, but what it is doing is acknowledging a fact, and therefore through limiting it and directing it, the people are able to come to a higher level through it. And at a certain point in history, like now, nobody does it. Yes, and that's why we have here the laws of not eating milk and meat, that if you're going to be allowed to eat meat, right, so at least there should be a limitation that you should not in any way eat milk and meat as if they are on the same level. Right? But at the very least, one should maintain a certain sensitivity and recognition that eating meat is in no way and should in no way be compared to and feel acceptable as the eating of milk. Okay. Therefore, the various laws are at least conditioning what we are allowed to do as a method of directing us to the ideal. Yeah.
So why is separating milk and meat that the highest form of man's relationship with God?
Well, it expressed one of the highest because it's one of the laws that really don't make any sense. I mean, even what I just said is very nice, but then based on that, not to eat. You know, if a drop of milk falls, you know, I mean, all the particular laws, I mean, the laws of eating milk and meat are what's called the chok. They really don't have a rational reason to them. It's just simply the will of God. So that expresses the highest level of relationship with God.
Meat represents death and milk represents life.
Yeah, that's very nice, but that's not enough to continue to tell people not to eat milk and meat in every situation. That's the point. The point is, ultimately, it's still considered a chok. Because, right, like, you know, rational thinking is not enough to continually stop a person from eating milk and meat together. It's like a nice idea, but now, what's wrong with my cheeseburger? So ultimately, it goes beyond an idea. It's the will of God. Right? It's the will of God. Yeah. It's the same thing as saying, well, I want to perform all the mitzvahs, so there's a mitzvah to give your wife a divorce. So, and there's also a mitzvah to return the stolen articles that you stole. So first you'll steal, so you can, you know, there's no, and that's not the way the laws were given. So you could get all the mitzvahs that you can, right? So the mitzvahs were given as a direction towards maintaining your relationship and creating your relationship with God daily.
The way God wants us to live.
The basic idea is you cannot always assume that what is written in Jewish law represents the ideals of Judaism. Being that it's halakha, it is the way to the ideals of Judaism. Right? And therefore, sometimes the way to the ideals do not always represent the ideals. I mean, like, let's say you went into a halfway house, right? And you see that they're giving out to the patients a, you know, couple grams of, you know, heroin. You say, oh, wow, what a place. This place believes that you can give heroin. Right? No, but they don't believe. But they just realize that the only way to draw these people out is not through cold turkey, right? But rather through a graduating process of breaking it up and slowly pulling them out of it. So this concept is what Maimonides brings down as a principle. In terms of understanding that the Torah was given to a human being according to the Yetzer Hara. Another example we have is what's called a captured woman. There's a law, if you're in war and you see a, you know, prisoner of war, attractive woman, you want to take her home. So the law gives you, Torah gives you various laws what you do. You can take her home, but you're not allowed to physically have contact with her for about a month. And you gotta let her hair grow and let her nails grow and until she basically becomes quite unattractive. And she's supposed to sit by your door and she cries all day for her mother and her father. So I mean, you know, you're not really so interested after you hear that. But it does. It's not as hard to say no when you see that, rather than if the Torah would say no, you can't do it. I mean, that's the way it is in war. In war, the general practice had been that, you know, you see an attractive woman in prison, you just take her home. So the Gemara says that the Torah is talking to the Yetzer Hara of the Ben Adam, talking to the evil inclination of the human being. Instead of saying no, which will only make it even more attractive, the Torah says yes, but within these particular limitations and conditions, which would then slowly convince you that it's not worth it. It's just an educational format that slowly gets you out of it. Well, you can't really say that, because as I mentioned before, what would happen if we saw again a serious problem in the community where people were taking advantage of hired help, and that the conditions that were offered to the hired help were so terrible and so dangerous that perhaps it would be better to reinstitute slave laws, and that people should start purchasing these people, because if you purchase this person, you'll take much better care of them had you just hired them. So you don't know. In certain situations, that which might seem immoral is a much more moral way to deal with the problem. But what you have to understand is halacha deals with a problem. Right? And that's the beautiful thing about Judaism. That's the beautiful thing about Sinai. Sinai is this moment of incredible transcendence, and yet it still realizes that these people are human beings. And that the Torah wasn't given to angels. The Torah was given to human beings, human drives, human shortcomings, and therefore immediately, that's the beauty of the Torah, it doesn't go off and off on all the spiritual things. Right? It gets right down to, and so, if you want to know what seeing face to face God means, it means what happens if your ox goes out and hurts another ox. That's what it means. That's really what it means. If you want to get back to Sinai, it's through Parshas Mishpatim. That's why, in a funny way, it kind of like brings us to the beginning, according to Rashi's Pshat. We kind of like, at the end of it, we end up at the beginning of Aseret Dibrot, just about to hear God saying, I am your God. And so chronologically, if that's not the case, then why was it put that way? And I believe because that's the point. The point is Mishpatim takes you right back to the first face-to-face, I am God, your God. Right? And that there is not a separation between, oh, you know, there's those legalistic Talmudic types, and then there's the spiritual types that like to really pray and daven all day. No. No, you can't have one without the other. Right? You simply cannot have one without the other. If you don't have that basic sensitivity of who's responsible and upon who is the onus, if I set fire and it goes out this way, right? Or whatever all these very particular laws seem to be very unspiritual, you know? That's the way to Sinai. If you want to see yourself standing in front of God once again on Har Sinai, then this is the way. It's through Mishpatim. Right? It's through the Gemara. That kind of sensitivity to want to know what's right in terms of my relation with the human being is the way to spirituality. And I'm tired of seeing people who come from the East. Right? I heard a story. Fellow came from the East, and the East, right, Boston, came from India. So someone brought him to Rav Getz. Rav Getz is this big Kabbalist, very famous Kabbalist, and Rav Getz is up all night long in the inner chambers by the Kotel, all the way back there. He does meditations in Yehudim all night long. I mean, we're talking about it. A very significant Mikubo. You don't see him that much. He doesn't walk around that much. He's not feeling so well. But he wears a complete white garb with a white shtreimel. And he's the Rav of the Kotel. He takes care of the Kotel. And so somebody brought him this hip guy from the East to be meditating and what happened. So he goes into Rav Getz, Kabbalist, and he says, listen, Rabbi, I've been in the East. I'm a Jewish boy. But I want you to know in the East, I saw miracles. I saw miracles. I saw people fly. I saw people walk through walls. I saw people lying on a bed of nails. Right? You know, I saw really superhuman qualities. Could you please tell me, what does Judaism have to offer me? So Rav Getz looked at him and he said, "Well, I'm sorry. All we've got is love your neighbor as yourself." Right? See, that's the point. What is all that stuff? I mean, it's nice for a circus, but for a living, right? For living, I don't care if the guy could sleep on a bed of nails. I'm more concerned whether he can sleep in a bed next to somebody and not treat them like dirt. Ah, right? That's a different kind of person. Right? So all these mishpatim, which seem very dry, you know, you walk in the Beit Midrash, people aren't sitting there meditating, but what they're doing is they're arguing over what's right. Right, in terms of their daily responsibilities and human responsibilities and consequences, that's how you get back to the face-to-face lofty experience at Sinai. That's the only way. There's only a real way to do it. And all the spiritualism is very nice, but if it doesn't have the vessels of the day-to-day responsibilities of how one treats their fellow neighbor, right, then it really does not have a foundation. Yeah?
The slavery laws don't really apply to us.
Well, they do apply if someone were to buy a slave, but it's just something that Jews don't even do.
Right. It's just not done. So are there principles that we're supposed to pull out of these that apply practically to us today, even though...
Oh, there's plenty that still do, of course. I mean, if you are oxen in terms of your car...
Right,
and
in terms of slavery.
No, in terms of slavery, there's all kinds of philosophical implications also. You understand that these laws are not only practical, but they have... with every detail, a philosophical and also Kabbalistic implication. Right, that too. Right, so it's not like they became unimportant and we wouldn't sit there and study them. We would sit and study the Gemara about slaves and the various details, even though we might not contemporarily ever do it anymore, because there's something about it that philosophically still directs us in our relationship to our human beings and our fellow man that we need to know.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.